Okay. So, unless you belong to a pretty rare category of people that experience little to no desire for intimate sexual experience, it's likely that you have, or you will, think about sexual love and intimacy, romance and partnership at some point in your life. Perhaps you might have even considered what the Bible has to say about these things, if it has anything to say about them at all. You may have heard that there are some things that good Christians do, and some things that they shouldn't do. It's likely, when you've asked, why shouldn't we do those things, the answers are far less quick in coming than the instructions to begin with. And scarcely are the answers satisfying. Likely, you've heard a lot of the what of the Bible's sexual ethic, but not so much, if anything at all, of the why. Whether you are single, dating, married, sexually active, blissfully naive, or abstinent, it's likely that you will think at some point in your life about your sexual nature, your intimate desire. And what I mean by human sexual nature is that as a human being, you've been created to desire physical and spiritual intimacy with another person. And what at all could this possibly have to... So what at all could this possibly have to do with your faith in Jesus? The Bible doesn't ignore this question. It doesn't ignore that we were created to desire. In fact, right in the middle of the scripture sits this poem, an entire book dedicated to the kind of love that's exclusive, intimate, mutual, passionate, the kind of love that God has for his people, played out here between two people. It's called the Song of Solomon, or the Song of Songs, or the best song about Solomon, or Solomon's Song of Songs. We're not sure. It's tricky to translate. This series, though, is about you hearing answers to your faith-filled questions that are robust and satisfying, and that reflect a solid understanding of how your sexuality and your spirituality are linked. Your sexual nature and your spirituality are linked. Beyond the caricatures, beyond sexual ethic, into the why, into God's heart. But a full disclaimer here. We are working very hard to put all of this together in a way that's clear, invitational, and loving. You may have already thought, Cain's speaking way slower than he usually does. But I will likely get it wrong for someone somewhere along the line. Maybe for one of you in this room right now. So please, as we wrestle with these things, consider these things. If you find yourself frustrated, offended, confused, ashamed, seek us out. And there are a whole number of ways that you can do that. You can email me. You can email Kirsty, my wife, whose email address is on the website. You can email any of the ministers. You can put an anonymous question in on the website and it will get to me and I will address it at some point. What I would request you not to do is just stew in it. Talk to the people around you. Have one of them come and talk to me. But don't stew. All right. Ready to get into it? Let's do it. The Song of Songs is not embarrassed at all by human love. It demonstrates what human love was created to look like, right? It's the absolute optimal expression, and it celebrates it. This love is passionate, sexual, intimate, mutual, gentle, exclusive. And at the same time, the song points beyond itself towards God's faithful love for his people that is also passionate, intimate, mutual, exclusive. It is both a love poem and a theological vision of what love is meant to become, of God's love for us, of the Redeemer receiving his people, warts and all, with love. But there is a problem in the song, and that is that it's a poem. In fact, it's an erotic love poem. And I'll go out on a limb here and say that erotic love poetry is probably not most of our preferred leisure reading. Perhaps poetry itself is something that we're not super familiar with. We've grown up with stories, sure, and stories in the Bible, easy. We know what to do with stories, right? Mostly we understand narratives, but our stories often gloss over the bits about human intimacy, especially in our Sunday schools. We're much more committed, though, to the letters of the New Testament, pretty clear lists of instructions, things to do, things not to do, things to pray, things not to pray, things to eat, things not to eat. Even if we don't like what those letters say, at least we can come to a pretty clear understanding about what it says. Well, poetry's not like that. Poetry works through images and metaphors and emotion and imagination. You've got to feel it, right? But that means it works through the images and the emotion and the imagination and the metaphor of the context in which it was written first, not ours. When the song compares a woman to a mare in among Pharaoh's chariot pullers, or speaks about gazelles or gardens, it's not trying to confuse you. It's attempting to make us come a bit of reality of God's love for us and his design for human love. To see ourselves before God in richer and fuller ways. To read the song well, then, we need to sit down and learn. Sorry, we need to slow down. We need to inhabit the poetry rather than rush past it. And one of the very first things that we could rush past when we read Solomon's Song of Songs is chapter 1, verse 1. Solomon's Song of Songs. The best song about Solomon, or Song of Songs, or Song of Songs of King Solomon. Let me help explain it like this, perhaps. Published an article. I was just flicking through Instagram at one point. Terrible habit. I was flicking through Instagram and I saw a post that made me laugh a lot. I don't often share much from social media, but I did share this. It said, "Victorian Liberals promise to bring back the level crossings." And I giggled a lot. I had a big laugh at that post. I thought it was very funny. But then I looked in the comment section of that particular article and it seemed that a few people didn't think it was very funny, that bringing back the level crossings would be ridiculous. We've just spent all of this time and money and effort on getting rid of the crossings, but now we're going to bring them back. It's an absolute waste of public resources and a stupid thing for the opposition party to be running into an election promising. But what I knew, that perhaps they didn't, was that the news outlet was the Batuta Advocate, a newspaper specialising in a particular brand of satire. Everyone knows that it's satire, unless you don't, which makes it pretty funny for people like me in the comments section. And I often share things like that in earnest, just to see what happens. The article assumes that you know the Batuta Advocate is satire. And if it is satire, it is satire. The song expects us to read it in the context of King Solomon. Rather than the author here, the song wants us to read the song in his legacy in love. There are more clues in the verses that we heard tonight, and I'll draw them out when we get to them. But first and foremost, the song is framing itself. The poet is framing the song, everything we hear from here, through the lens of King Solomon's love, legacy in love. Maybe you don't know what that is. But also, that would be different depending on when the song was written, right? So likely, the song, I'm assuming this for the next 6 weeks, the song was written between around 500 to 200 BC. That's about as tight as most anyone is happy to get it. Now, that's the time in which the people of God have just been given permission to return to the promised land. They've been in exile in Babylon, and now a group of them, volunteering, can go back and start to rebuild the temple and reclaim the promised land. A minority culture set apart to the people of God, entering a hotbed for the kind of idol worship that had got them thrown into exile in the first place. A time in which having sex with, marrying, binding and unifying yourself intimately with foreign women or women that worship other gods, to better translate it, joining them in their worship is the reason that Israel has been in exile. So how does this time understand Solomon's legacy in love? Pretty complicated. Solomon is probably the most complicated character in Scripture. He's not quite a good guy only, but he's not quite a villain either. He's complicated. He's remembered as a king unlike any other to walk the face of the earth by Nehemiah and Ezra, the most wise and wealthy, the most prosperous. One Kings 10 tells us the story of when the Queen of Sheba visited him, that she was so impressed by his wealth and his wisdom that she gave him more wealth. 1 Kings 10 then goes on to tell us that he accumulated many chariots, many more horses, that he made money by buying those chariots from Egypt and selling them to the Amorites and the Hittites, buying weapons from his enemies and selling them to his enemies. Complex, right? He also accumulated 666 talents of gold, which should prick your ear. This is Bible for a spiritually dangerous amount of gold. And then in 1 Kings 11, we see that despite all of his wealth and his wisdom, he married 700 wives of royal birth, foreign wives, women that worship other gods, and 300 concubines. And that it's this entwining himself with those that worship other gods sexually that caused him to lead the nation in idolatry. The context here is a kind of worship, a kind of cultic sexual worship that defames and brings dishonor to the God of Israel, that Solomon was beginning to synchronize, so like worship in the same way as idols from other nations. Nehemiah, writing at the time of the return to the promised land, negative example. He points to these things. And was it not because of the marriages like these, He's responding to the Israelites that have returned, marrying with women that worship other gods. Is it not because of marriages like these that Solomon, king of Israel, sinned? Among the many nations, there was no king like him. He was loved by his God. God made him king over all of Israel. But even he was led into sin by women that worship other gods. If you're a minority culture going back into the land and you begin to mix yourselves up with the people that are there, that culture disappears pretty quickly. The rest of Nehemiah tells the story, and Ezra too, that the Hebrew language couldn't be spoken by the children of those people, that they'd forgotten their worship practices. And this is just in one generation. The Bible here, the scripture, the song, is asking us to remember Solomon and his failure in love, his promiscuous, polygamous, autocratic, and objectifying in love as a negative example that the song will create the optimal against. Or better said, the song's optimal will cast itself against Solomon's failure and demonstrate that who we are intimate with, we ought be careful who we are intimate with, because it will impact the way that we worship God. That's one of the key messages that will come through the song. So that's verse one. That sets us up for how we read and receive everything else. This King Solomon. And then it fades to black, and lights come up on a young woman pouring her heart out. Verse 2. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful. You can almost see or hear, if this were a film, that we'd get this gaudy 10-minute kind of about King Solomon and like the negative image that he is. And then the lighting would get brighter, the sun would come up, and this young woman would be doting over her lover. It gives us her heart, her context. She's passionately driven here to seek out her lover, right? She wants to be near him, to kiss him and be kissed by him. The mutual affection that you see here, the playful, passionate intimacy, is going to come up again and again and again in the song. But there's something else. Right at the start, there's this allusion to the king again. The king bringing her into his chambers, or at least desiring to bring her into his chambers. And we're not told who this king is, but the only king the song has mentioned so far is Solomon. It's easy for us to rush ahead and assume, because it's a king and Solomon is in the title of the book, that this king is Solomon or the lover is Solomon, but we don't know that yet. In fact, she seems a little hesitant for that to be the case. The image that we have of Solomon seems to be in stark contrast to the one that she's painting now of her beloved. The daughters of Jerusalem, one of the characters that we'll see pop up again and again in the song, are going to function kind of like a chorus. If you've ever done any like theatre or like read any Greek tragedies or comedies, they're going to function kind of like a chorus. The woman will speak to them, reckon with them, and ultimately instruct them. They seem pretty pumped about this idea of an invitation into the king's chambers. Some sort of allusion to the daughters of Israel, that the community of the people of God being like, yeah, this is great. This kind of love is a good thing to pursue. The woman's not convinced. She is addressing the daughters of Jerusalem now in 5-7. Perhaps she's addressing the beloved, or perhaps it's both, but she reveals her own situation. She's got darkened, sunburnt skin, rough features, probably calluses on her hands. Her brothers seem to have oppressed her and forced her to work in the fields, in the vineyard. Those that are meant to care for her and watch over her in the absence of a father haven't cared for and watched over her. They're actually meant to organize a marriage, a union, some sort of joining of families that blesses her and blesses the family. But instead, they put her to work. If we remember, Ruth 2 reminds us that a vineyard is not the safest place for a woman in 1st century, 5th century BC, or even at the time, or especially at the time of the Judges. Boaz needs to specifically instruct his laborers to not lay a finger on her and to actively look out for her, letting her sit in the shelter with the rest of the workers to rest. The vineyard is not a safe place for Ruth. The vineyard is not a safe place in the context of the song either. But more than simply danger, the vineyard's a metaphor for her body. She tells us that she hasn't tended to her own vineyard. And whilst commentators of the 20th century tended to gloss over this reference as about just her physical beauty or her appearance, it's becoming increasingly understood that the poetic image of the woman toiling away in the vineyard, unable to tend to her own body, her own vineyard, is likely a suggestion or a revelation or perhaps a confession that she has transgressed sexual boundaries, whether willingly or coerced. It's likely because it's used in the song increasingly in this manner to represent her intimate self. 1:8 is a bit of a curious line. It's the daughters, her response to the daughters. It's his response to her. So others think it's the daughter's response to her. Either way, it seems to be this like cheeky barb. Well, if you don't know where he is, go and find him. And it reminds me, it's 9, right? Like wisdom puts herself where she expects to find an audience for her wisdom. It's like the song here, the poet here is going, if you have a beloved, put yourself where you know they are. Perhaps the woman is being encouraged to go where she expects to find the audience and adoration. The audience of one, that is. And then his reception of her in 1:9 is one of enveloping, loving. She has perhaps revealed breaking sexual boundaries. But his response is that you, my love, are utterly beautiful. Instead of fixating on her past, he dotes on her, pours out all of the other things that he adores about her, gives us an image that she, despite all oppression and injustice done to her, is still desirable and attractive. And in his mind, not just to him, but of to others as well. I compare you, my love, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariot horses. Horses that pull chariots were stallions, male horses, ungelded. That means they have all of their parts still. And a mare, a female, is a female. And it's not hard to imagine the kind of chaos or pandemonium that would erupt if a mare was let loose in and amongst the field of stallions. And I wonder if the tone of this moment is kind of lost on us. We have quite a modest and conservative spoken culture in and around kind of public relationship. But I wonder if this moment, the tone of it, is kind of like a woman telling her partner that another man's just checked her out. And he says, of course they did, you're gorgeous. But at the same time, in that public place, he moves toward her. This is her, both cheeky and a little bit, there's a bit of a banter here, but it's also protective. and assuring that if this happened in a nightclub, that scene would clearly play out, that he sees her and knows her and is here with her. He moves intimately toward her. Despite the history, building for us a picture of love that meets the whole person now, not dis. We practiced confession earlier in the service, where we come to God as we are and he receives us in his love and his goodness. He doesn't focus on the past. No, the beloved moves forward intimately, exclusively, and mutually. He's quick to pour out adoration on her, calling to attention her beautiful cheeks, her adorned neck. Again, this is poetry. She isn't wearing jewelry. The image of Pharaoh's chariot probably brought up splendid, fabulous, grand chariot adorned with all sorts of silly paraphernalia, representing power and wealth and authority. He's adorning her with those same things here.